6th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. We seem to be in the midst of an upsurge in dystopian art and end times anxieties. If we as a culture don't have a sense of impending doom, we do at least have trouble imagining the future being bright and promising. Today's guest, Lucy Corin, is here on Between the Covers to talk about her new book from McSweeney's, 100 Apocalypses and Other Apocalypses, a book playful both in form and content that looks at this cultural moment from every perspective imaginable. Lucy Corin is the author of the novel Everyday Psycho Killers, The History of Girls, and the short story collection The Entire Predicament from Tin House Books. She's also the program director of the creative writing program at UC Davis and the winner of the 2012 American Academy of Arts and Letters Rome Prize, who described her writing as follows. Lucy Corin sounds like no one, prickly, shrewd, faintly paranoid or furtive, witty and also savage. She has something of Paley's gift for soliloquy combined with Dickinson's passionate need to hold the world at bay, that sense of a voice emanating from a Skinner box. Her achievement is already dazzling, her promise immense. Welcome to Between the Covers, Lucy Corin.
Thanks, David.
So let's start with this cultural moment where we're seeing a ton of art, high art and commercial art about dystopia, the end of times, apocalyptic energy. How much do you see 100 Apocalypses as participating in this cultural moment, and how much is it a commentary on what's going on in our culture around it?
Well, I think that I wrote the book because I noticed it. I don't pretend to be like a historian who could compare our culture's fascination with the apocalyptic with other moments in history, but there's unquestionably like waves, and this is one of them, and I felt it. I felt this similarly in the 90s about the psycho killer narrative, and it was part of what prompted the writing of my first book. And then it was just in the air, and I wondered at my own fascination. I wondered at like the combined desire to keep participating and living through the end of everything, and I wondered about the pleasure of it. And I wondered about the persistence to do it repeatedly. Yeah.
Well, that brings me to this issue of juxtaposition in the book, that we see stories that are about true apocalypse, the world truly ending, crumbling, exploding. And then we also see that sort of juxtaposed against stories that have to do with smaller everyday things, but that are presented in an apocalyptic way. And that brings up for me as the reader the sense of the slow apocalypses that are happening in our lives, like climate change, and the way that we respond so much more strongly to our car breaking down, for instance, than to actually confronting things that are happening that are truly disastrous. Is that an effect that you were going for when you were putting these two different ways of looking at apocalypse next to each other?
I think what I was doing, and this is only retrospective, it's not anything that I knew I was doing while I was doing it. But if I think back on what sort of psychological thing I traced out in the book, it is that sense of like what's beyond your comprehension and then what is within your comprehension. And the thing that ties them together, exactly as you said, is the sensibility. And so if what you have is like an apocalyptic sensibility about things that are out of your control, one thing that seems true to me is that a person would apply that sensibility to what actually is right before them, the things that they think maybe they have a shot at, like having a decent relationship or not failing at your job or any of your or picking something to eat that will be satisfying. And that sort of sense of like of that precarious sense of like maybe I'll win or maybe I'll lose is it's conceivable in the daily. Yeah.
And do you find anything particularly compelling about apocalypse as narrative?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I mean, I'm a real a technical geek about my own form. I'm always interested. Like, my second book was all about the first person, and I just wanted to exhaust my relationship with the first person. It's the kind of thing that anybody who's not a writer like would never consider a subject matter, but probably almost anybody who's tried to write understands like the drive to like figure out your form. So yeah, I was thinking about the most fictiony fiction that existed. So I was interested in the idea of beginnings and endings, and having been a writer for what felt like a while, beginning and ending and beginning and ending and beginning and ending is like what you do every time you try and make something. And if you're working in fiction, you know, they say that the easiest way to think of a story is that it has a beginning and it has a middle and it has an end. And what Apocalypse does is take that literally and say, and just apply it to everything in the biggest way possible. And I'm interested in extremes. I'm interested in extremes in form, and I'm interested in extremes in content.
Well, it's interesting because the apocalypse is actually an ending and a beginning simultaneously,
exactly.
Isn't it? I mean, we think about the first one with the Noah's flood.
Mm-hmm.
God is doing it to both destroy the world and start it anew.
Exactly. And so what you have is like something that, like, if narrative is supposed to be about time passing, then what you have is a form that makes everything simultaneous, and it makes it simultaneously depicts time passing. And starting with a paradox that's also really easy to wrap your head around is delicious.
I have a quote here from an interview you did with West Branch magazine, and I think it might have been said while you were still in the process of finishing this book.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
You said, "It's kind of my goodbye to American, or maybe particularly hipster American, self-importance." And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what that means with regards to 100 Apocalypses and whether that still feels true to you around what the book is doing.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's characterized the period of time in history that I've lived through is that the idea of whose voice matters to the larger culture has shifted. I mean, I was in college when they were first changing the curriculum in order to embrace the idea of the multicultural. And that conversation has evolved radically in the last, you know, 20, 25 years. But what you see is like the idea of privilege being radically called into question. And that means that people in their different forms of privilege are having to question themselves in ways that they've never been asked with any force to do. And at the same time, what you have is like when the economy is shifting, and when your sense of like global power is shifting as intensely as it is right now, it's shaking, you know, it's shaking the status quo. And I was interested in that from where I stand myself, as somebody who had a fancy education, as somebody who has experienced both, as anybody has, a variety of forms of privilege, a variety of forms of outsiderness, and as any writer knows, wondering if what you have to say is important in any way. But this is a time in history when that's a giant question, like whose voice matters and whose voice matters in what way. And that's what I was interested in exploring, that sense of like, a lot of the voices in the book are voices of people who thought they were okay, people who thought they were cool, going, maybe I'm not cool.
Yeah.
And what if I'm not cool? Yeah.
And while that might not be an apocalypse, it is sort of an end and a beginning at the same time, depending on who you are. I mean, all of these, like VITA, the organization that's holding magazines accountable around huge gender disparity in both reviewers and who's being reviewed, could be seen as obviously a beginning,
mm-hmm.
but also for other people might feel apocalyptic if
exactly.
they're being held under the magnifying glass.
Exactly.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host, and we're talking today with Lucy Corin, the author of 100 Apocalypses and Other Apocalypses from McSweeney's.
Yeah.
So let's have our listeners hear a little bit of the prose and
okay.
100 Apocalypses and Other Apocalypses.
Okay. I'm starting with my one Halloween apocalypse, which is called Zombies. Last time, He'd lived near the tracks, heard the train, and no one did anything to prepare for Halloween. Some raided the fridge for eggs, evidently. Halloween was like most days, fear in the air. It marked time in the nation, in a parade with the other holidays. One year, in that town, he made a rule for the neighborhood kids. No costumes, no candy. He got together a bag of rags, masking tape, and markers from around the house. When the kids arrived in jeans and t-shirts, he wrapped one kid in shredded sheets. "Look, you're a mummy. Here's your candy." And he wrapped another one in shredded sheets. "Look, you're a Vietnam vet, back from the dead." "I'm a mummy," kids cried. "I'm back from the dead." But here, the kids across the cul-de-sac had lined their porch with intricate pumpkins. He went over to look at them. "That one's bored. That one's perplexed. That one's ambivalent," the boy said, pointing with a knife much too big and sharp for his body, but suited to his pirate outfit. The older sister, a girl in the 10th grade who practiced piano every evening, had used a pattern from a magazine to carve a wolf howling at the moon, with more and less pumpkin carved out to create depth, character, and shadow. She was inside the house, practicing. She was just about as close to him as the boy, but veiled through the window screen. "You've got some complex pumpkins going on over here," he said to the boy. "That's not complex," said the boy. "That doesn't even begin to be complex." In this town, he lived near the tracks, too. But on the other side, the construction of a new development paused indefinitely, a dozen houses wrapped in Tyvek. He fixed a drink and took a chair to his porch and sat with his basket of assorted miniatures. He liked Halloween. He liked the dying and then undying. When he was a kid, he said he wanted to be a boat, and his aunt made him a boat to wear. He was the captain, and he was also the boat, the aunt explained. His parents and their friends gathered around him in their witches' hats with bright cocktails and complimented him. But he still felt like he was just the captain, walking around in a boat. This town was a lot like the town he'd grown up in, something he'd been working toward for a long time. It had been a hard bunch of years. "I'm back from the dead," he'd thought, dropping the last box into his new living room. Here, though, the kids eyed him just as suspiciously. They eyed him with better vocabularies. And here, he felt himself looking at the town with as much bewilderment as he'd looked at the adults in the town where he'd been a child. Only now he was an adult. He walked with his drink to the center of the cul-de-sac. He turned around and around, just enough to get a little dizzy. Then he tried to aim himself home. But the apocalypse is not the wobbling away. The wobbling away is life persisting. The apocalypse is him spinning, with the drink clink-clinking, delicate potential to go faster and faster, to drill a hole into the earth with his body, or, and alternately, to dissipate centrifugally, like rings through water, into droplets, into air. One more. Bathing. One thing about after the apocalypse is you can't get dirt on you. I mean, you can, but you better not. It stings and itches like crazy, and I don't know about you, but I can't get anything accomplished if I don't feel clean. Plus, water's a problem, even after everything. And sand! You know, I read in a book when I was a kid about how to wash by scrubbing with sand, but now that's even worse. What would you expect? It's just another kind of dirt. Everything makes for one rash or another, some with welts, some with, well, stinking welts, or welts that take over your whole body, or welts that blend in with other people's welts, or welts on animals and trees, or the welts on the dirt and on the water. The whole point of the apocalypse was to feel clean. What a load.
I love that one. In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host, and we're talking today with Lucy Corin, the author of 100 Apocalypses and Other Apocalypses from McSweeney's. You've said that you love reading from the book because of the responses you're getting that have led you to conclude that everyone has an apocalyptic fantasy life. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that some people if you ask them what their apocalyptic fantasy is, you know, if you just ask somebody and you just assume that they and everybody has it, and I ask somebody, what is your apocalyptic fantasy or what's your favorite apocalypse? Some people will just know. They'll either know, like, you know, mine is the Mad Max kind where everybody's a kind of punk and that everything's like sexually charged and it's a desert and there's a lot of machines and there's no gas and it's everybody has a dog who's about to go mad at every moment. And some people will say, you know, it's an underwater one or it's whatever. It'll have a theme. It'll have a sensibility. It'll have like a sort of genre specific universe that comes with it. And then other people will be like, I don't know what you're talking about. But then if I ask them like two or three other questions, they'll find one. And sometimes it's something that they dream a lot. Sometimes it's something that they remember feeling as a child. And the next step I find in those conversations is that whatever their apocalyptic fantasy is composed of, it connects with things in the rest of their life that are dear to them. And that's a wonderful discovery for me, in part because it makes the sometimes impersonal job of trying to get your book out there feel like something that's going to help me make connections with human beings in a way that writing does, but only imaginarily. Hmm. Yeah.
Well, people with their secret apocalyptic fantasy lives should really go see you read because of your apocalyptic stamps that you give for readings, which brings me to this idea of form. I wanted to start out really talking about the content because there's so much playfulness around the form, mm-hmm. which you also do in these stamps that you've created where people can choose to have, you know, death by volcano or by flood or by bomb on their as stamped inside of their books. But also the book itself, it's really delightful as a physical object. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of playing with text in the margin, with text of different fonts, where even some text where you need a magnifying glass to read parts of.
Yeah.
And I wanted to hear more about that process and the appeal of breaking out of the box around the object that we read when we read 100 apocalypses.
Gosh, it's been such a part of my life, this like, do you, don't you break out of paragraphs? I've resisted it because I don't want to, I've resisted it because I have such fidelity to the short story and to prose fiction. And so I like to start with the most commonplace formal procedure there. I like to start with paragraphs that go all the way to the end. I like to start with like a typeface that doesn't announce itself as a typeface. I don't have pictures. I'd even try not to use parentheses or italics. You know, I try to keep it like super clean and like a brown bag philosophy of what your words should look like on the page. I think a lot even about like capital letters, you know, or I don't like to use all caps ever. And so then if I do deviate from that, it has to be either really playful or it has to be, it has to really make the piece three-dimensional in a way that it wouldn't otherwise be. So I like form and content to have to do with each other. I think, you know, the Beckett philosophy of form and content unity is central to my poetics, but
which makes McSweeney's a nice pairing for this book with
totally.
their crazy cutout, beautiful cover.
I know the cutout. I love the fact that, like, first of all, one of the things about the design that's so great is that the relationship between the title, the text and the title, and the book itself is playful, where it looks like the hardcover on the outside is pushing the text that shows through it aside a little, and also it makes the text look like it's disappearing into the past, or into the, it's like Star Wars in the beginning.
Or falling off a ledge.
Exactly.
Sort of when you run out of space at the end of the page.
Yeah, and I love that there's a hole in the book because there's so many holes in the content of the book. And
well, what do you see? How do you see the relationship of the three stories at the beginning and then the 100 flash fictions? The three stories are still playful with form. You do fairy tale that's referencing a Hans Christian Andersen in the margins, but they're more, in a lot of ways, and they're more close to traditional short stories than the flash fiction. So how do you see them relating to each other within the same cover?
Well, I feel like as a collection, simply thinking about the length as an aspect of form, it goes the shortest possible thing I can think of, and then the longest story in the book is practically a novella. Like, it's right on that line. The first three stories, I feel like the relationship with form is different in each one. Although they all have a relationship with apocalypse and the speculative. So in the first story, as you mentioned, it's a columnar story. The story is told twice, once in marginalia and once in the body. And the story itself references the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, The Tinderbox. And so you have, like, it's a double retelling, and that in itself is really funny to me. And it also stretches style. Like, part of the style is like sounds fairy tale, and part of the style sounds really like almost like 80s minimalism, like dirty, you know. Huh. And then and I like that idea of stretching style through time as I'm stretching form and reference through time. And then the other two stories are like They look super normal on the page, but one of them collages in these texts, these found documents from mental asylums, and so it's in some ways a really bizarre story, but it's presented in a really recognizable form.
Hmm.
And then the last story that precedes the 100 apocalyptic shorts is called Godzilla versus the Smog Monster, and that story is like so recognizable. It's just a father-son coming-of-age story, except California's burning across the country while it's happening. And in some ways, I feel like that story, I want it to earn me the right. If a person reads this book all the way through, by the time they get to Godzilla versus the Smog Monster, by the time they finish that story, I want them to really believe that I know what I'm doing, so that then they'll go with it when I get really silly in the apocalypses. They'll know that I'm silly, but I'm also not silly.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting strategy.
Yeah.
And I like how in the two of the last long short stories, Madman and then the one Smog Monster, they both have to do with things that feel apocalyptic that happen to everybody. Puberty. Yeah. I mean, obviously we have the issue of mental illness in Madman, but we also have the issue of
right.
of puberty, the metamorphosis and the apocalyptic metamorphosis of puberty. And then California is in that story serves as a place of dreams, like a place where you could go mm-hmm. to escape from your horrible life.
Absolutely.
And if California is gone, that's the apocalypse more than the literal burning of California, it seemed like. It's really, really beautifully rendered.
Thanks for reading it that way.
And lastly, in terms of playfulness, I've heard you mention that you really submitted a lot of these flash fiction pieces before you felt like they were fully complete when you were submitting them to magazines.
Yeah.
And I want to hear a little bit about that process and if that was a freeing up process or a challenge to yourself and what the purpose of generating short fiction in that manner and then exposing yourself around it when you felt like maybe the edges were still rough.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, I have a real fidelity to the traditional short story as a pursuit. And one of the things that's so attractive I've found to me about writing short stories is this sense that you can make it perfect. And the way that I was taught, that's what it was all about, is like taking language so seriously and treasuring it so much that you were going to choose every word and arrange every word, and it could become this crystalline globe shining in the night. You know, that the short story as a form had the potential for that in a way that, like, wasn't what novels were for.
Right.
And I worked very hard with that aesthetic in mind and with that history of the story in mind, and I still treasure it. But more and more, I've started to own the part of my writing life that knows that that's in itself is a fiction, that even if I make something perfect in the next moment because time passed, it will be different. And then in the next moment, it'll be different. And then that doesn't even take into the account that it moves into the world. And if people read it, then their brains are doing their work on it. And so I know sort of intellectually that the text changes every second, and that I have no control over it at all, and that I have no authorship or whatever, right? But there's something so valuable about the fiction of that kind of authority that's absolutely connected with the idea of the apocalyptic and the idea of writing and the idea of, like, whether or not you can stop time or maneuver time in that way. So what was great about what I tried to do with this project was get a little less precious with it. Like, what if I stop kidding myself that I have control over this narrative? What if I stop kidding myself that there's some moment when it's going to be perfect? What if I do what I can and then I stop agonizing and then I just send it out and I see what happens when some editor looks at it and they like it or they don't like it? And it was freeing, right? And it was also surprising, and it confirmed what I thought, which is, if I sent out 6 stories and I thought that one of them was done and one of them was ragged, just as likely the editor would think the opposite. Hmm. Yeah.
That's really interesting. Can you share a little bit about what you're working on now?
Well, now I'm writing a novel. I stretched the story form for myself in one way in my first collection and in a very different way in this story collection. And my first book was a novel, and it was a novel that was that embraced the fragment in a lot of ways, that was that was episodic. And I wanted to write a novel that tried to be as smooth as possible and formally. So, like, I started a lot of the writing of this novel started where I decided not to put paragraphs in at first. I'm putting paragraphs in now, but I didn't want to assume where the paragraphs would go. I wanted to say, like, what if it's just one block? And I try to wipe away my assumptions of the rhythmic work and the conceptual work that paragraphing does.
Do you feel like that is in response to all of these short flash fiction pieces?
It absolutely. Is. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So it's in dialogue with what you've just completed.
Yeah. It's like, what if I the first thing I was like, well, what if I wanted to do something where instead of collage being something that's about a fragmented world, I'm thinking less and less about our experience as fragmented and more of our experience as just layered and in motion. And so I want the form to be about that, which is a smoother thing. It's not a frenetic experience. It should be like a series of motions. Yeah.
Well, I look forward to reading it.
Well, thank you.
It was great having you on Between the Covers.
Thanks so much, David.
So we're talking today with Lucy Corin, the author of 100 Apocalypses and Other Apocalypses. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the Vagabond Opera's 7th annual Day of the Dead Bash, the Transylvanian Voodoo Ball. This concert and Day of the Dead celebration honoring the ancestors is coming up on November 1st, 8 p.m. at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. The neo-gypsy cabaret Vagabond Opera and the Russian gypsy punk band Chervona will play, along with many special guests. Bring mementos for the Day of the Dead altar to honor lost loved ones. There will be a costume contest with prizes. That's the Vagabond Opera's 7th annual Day of the Dead Bash The Transylvanian Voodoo Ball, at the Star Theater on November 1st. More information can be found on the right-hand side of the KBOO.FM website, under Community Events.
KBFA brings the listening public the other point of view.
There was a strong sense that this was the beginning of something that would spread across the country.
On Sunday, November 3rd, at the historic Hollywood Theater, KBOO presents an exclusive benefit screening of the film KPFA On the Air.
This documentary tells the powerful story of the beginnings of listener-sponsored radio in the United States with the birth of Pacifica in Berkeley in 1949.
KPFA On the Air chronicles the origins of the free speech movement, the first stirrings of the student movements at Berkeley, in opposition to the Vietnam War in the early 1960s.
Eventually spawning a network of free-form, independent radio stations across the country, including KBOO, which came on the air in 1968. So come join us at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard, Sunday, November 3rd, at 7 in the evening.
Help keep community radio strong and thriving into the future.
I'm Joshua Samuel Brown, and this is Improbability Drive. Today we'll be looking at social media, specifically at how writers are increasingly using social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter as part of their work. As a writer, I have something of a mixed relationship with social media. I love the ease with which I can get positive feedback for my work, but I'm less thrilled with the way social media eats up so much of my time. I've also become increasingly aware of how social media tends to feed my, let's just call them my narcissistic tendencies. Several years ago, Richard Deming, a dear friend and fellow writer, made a quip about me. This was before social media had become big, so it was probably over the phone or by email. Richard called me